Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Priya Menon joining you from India, and today we are talking about multiple myeloma. The myeloma panel is led by Gary Peterson, myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com and co-host of today's show. Joining Gary on the panel are myeloma survivors and advocates Jack Aiello and Yelek Biro. The featured expert on the talk is Dr. Rafael Fonseca, hematologist-oncologist at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Fonseca, welcome to Cure Talks. Such a pleasure to have you with us again.
Oh, pleasure is mine. Thank you.
In 2017, stem cell transplant remained a key option for treatment of eligible multiple myeloma patients, and in majority of patients, it is done as a part of frontline therapy. Research show that stem cell transplants significantly increases the amount of time for which a patient has the disease under control. How safe are transplants? Who is eligible to get one? What are the side effects and how can patients tackle them? In the coming hour, the panel will talk to Dr. Fonseca for answers to these and more on the latest developments in stem cell transplant technology for multiple myeloma treatment. Gary will be leading the talk, but before I hand over to Gary, I would like to inform the audience that we will be addressing questions sent in towards the end of the discussion. If you have a question for Dr. Fonseca, please email priya@trialx.com or post on Cure Talks website. You can also press 1 on your keypads and we can bring you on air to ask your questions directly. With that, it's over to Gary.
Thanks again, Priya, for bringing all the myeloma patients this forum for discussion. And, of course, thank you, Dr. Fonseca, for all that you do. In my opinion, and I think in most people's opinion, you are one of the premier myeloma specialists in the world. So thank you so much for being here. Dr. Fonseca received his medical degree from the University Anahuac School of Medicine, Mexico City. He continued his postgraduate studies with a residency in internal medicine at the University of Miami and a fellowship in clinical hematology and medical oncology at Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. So Dr. Fonseca is currently deputy director Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, Getz Family Professor of Cancer and Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, as well as a site director for hematological malignancies at Mayo Clinic Scottsdale, Arizona. Dr. Fonseca is a fellow at the International Society of Hematology and is board certified in internal medicine, medical oncology, and hematology. In addition, he holds professional memberships in the American Association of Cancer Research, American Society of Hematology, and many other organizations. He also has written more than 100 peer-reviewed articles, books, and abstracts. He's reviewed in numerous journals, including the American Journal of Hematology, American Journal of Medical Blood, Medicine, Blood, and many other journals as well. So Dr. Fonseca has developed an expertise in the measurement of plasma cell disorders, and he was actually sent from Rochester to Scottsdale to develop a myeloma program, and obviously has done a great job of doing that. So welcome, Dr. Fonseca.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you all here today. You're very kind.
Great. Well, thank you. You certainly have helped the myeloma patient community tremendously. So, first of all, it's like to transplant or not to transplant. That is the question. which is correct? Can you discuss with our audience why there is this question and what is the evidence which has mounted up to favor transplant?
Sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity again. As we were discussing just briefly before the call, the question of transplant remains relevant now as it was 20 years ago. And for the first 20 years, the myeloma community spent a lot of time and resources and devoted itself to do the clinical trials to prove that transplant was superior to no transplant. And more recently, with the advent of better therapeutics, the question is the exact opposite. So there's clinical trials that are wondering, is transplant still needed as care for patients with multiple myeloma? So we've spent the first 20 years proving that it was needed, and then there's almost an interest now in proving that it may not be needed. So we'll try to cover this questions during this conversation. And I think part of the theme that we have here is to demystify stem cell transplant as a treatment option for patients with myeloma. So we can start with some general comments and then go down into the controversy.
Please do.
The first one is transplant is just, and I say just with caution because I know it implies many, many things, but it's just one more line of treatment in the care of a myeloma patient. And it's an important treatment. It's a big deal, of course, but it's a treatment that has allowed us to provide an option for patients that can result in durable responses. That's probably the most important concept behind the idea of a stem cell transplant, is that patients can have the treatment that will lead to a durable response. Now, the reason it's durable is twofold. First of all, the responses with transplant can be very deep. For those members in the audience who may not be familiar with the terminology, you should know that the words response and remission mean exactly the same in medical terminology. So we classify that. We'll say, patient has a partial remission or partial response. Or if there's no longer ability to measure the disease, we'll say maybe the patient is in a complete response. So that's one feature why transplant works. It produces very deep responses. But the second one, which is very important, is that some of those responses are quite durable. And that's independent of what one does after transplant. So much so that just in 2011, a Spanish group reported on very long-term outcomes of patients treated with stem cell transplant. And they were able to show that if you look at patients who achieved a complete response based on the criteria that they had at the time and based on the measurements they had for disease at the time, about a third of those patients had no disease recurrence. And that was with a follow-up of up to 20 years. So the question is it durable? Yes, it can be, and it can be very deep. And for those two reasons, transplant has traditionally enjoyed an advantage. When people ask the question, is it better to go through a transplant or not? And the clinical trials have compared transplant to no transplant in the past. As I mentioned, and most of them show an advantage for using transplant early on. So that is the reason why we do stem cell transplant in myeloma. That would be kind of a first opening statement, and then I'm sure we'll delve into some of the controversies.
Okay, well, thank you. One of the things I've noticed in talking to people is there is just a fear of transplant, whether it's founded or not. What are the reasons that they have this fear, and why do people choose not to transplant, and what are valid reasons and which are myth? For one, I heard more than once of people saying that I'm going to get leukemia if I have a transplant. Mm. But I did some research myself, and I found little evidence online. What's your take on this? It's a fear.
Sure. Yeah, it's the one treatment that's probably feared the most. And when we talk to our patients, some of them have heard about transplant and come with a natural fear of that any one of us would have when we face a larger medical treatment, as opposed to, say, taking pills and injections, which in and of themselves can sometimes be just as risky as the transplant itself. I always tell my patients the following. If we're going to go through the transplant, I know that we know what we're doing, and our nursing staff and our medical staff knows exactly what we're doing, to the point that for a medical team that does transplants on a regular basis, it is a routine procedure. And I always follow that with my statement. I know it will never be routine to you because this is a big deal for the individual. But for the medical teams that care for patients who are going through a stem cell transplant, this is a procedure that we're very familiar with. We know what to expect, and we know how to react. In fact, the safety of a stem cell transplant is as high, or if not higher, than that of all other combination chemotherapies. When you look at large series of patients, we say that a transplant center of excellence should have a mortality rate of approximately 1% or less. And if you actually start digging down into those numbers, we sometimes run into more serious complications if someone, you know, has pre-existing heart condition or a pulmonary condition, and there may be other risk factors. But for the average patient, it should be a very safe procedure. The big downside is that it's almost like you compress everything into just a few days. Instead of getting, you know, as people get chemotherapy, and for those who have received it, you might think of, well, the chemo you get before the transplant, you kind of spread it out over, you know, 4 months. So you kind of pay the toxicity in installments to some degree. And transplant, on the other hand, is like buying your house cash. You know, you have to deal with everything all at once. So you go through the one treatment, the treatment is one infusion and one period of recovery. So we concentrate a lot of that toxicity, a lot of that recovery in a short period of time, but with the hope of achieving what I previously mentioned, which was a durable response. But if you look at the numbers, it's really important to remember that transplant is actually a very, very safe procedure. And the other word I sometimes hear, sometimes patients might tell me, well, this is like a Hail Mary pass situation where we're only going to use transplant if we really need to. And my answer to that is no. Actually, for the suitable candidate, and we can expand on that a little bit later, but for the suitable candidate, transplant should be considered as frontline therapy, as your primary approach, your initial strategy against the disease. And again, it's fair to say it's a very safe procedure. Now, I don't ever pretend to minimize the toxicity that comes with going through a transplant. And some of you in the audience who've been through this, you know that there's some significant problems with appetite, with ability to tolerate foods, associated weakness and recovery time. And that's something we have to be quite mindful, but it can be done from a medical perspective in a very safe way.
All right. Well, I think the 1% that you're talking about is that when I talk to people, it almost seems like they've got 50%, you know, stuck in their brain for some reason, you know, that the fear of death from stem cell transplant is far, far, far greater than what the reality is. So I, you know, it just seems to be a very, very big misconception.
Yeah, that's a very important number. And I would say just, again, if someone else in the audience who may be dealing with a related condition, amyloidosis, we actually have these numbers quite precise. For amyloidosis, the number goes up substantially. The number goes up to about 2 to 3%, maybe 4%. But even then, it's far from that 50%. So I think it's important to remind people that it's really a safe procedure.
Oh, the other thing, too, is that based on the SEER data, you know, from the National Cancer Institute, that 20% of patients die within the first year. So you're more likely to die from the myeloma than you are from the stem cell transplant.
Yeah, and if I could build on that comment, then, of course, that's something that we don't like to talk a lot about, but, you know, the biggest threat for the person, and usually more so than the side effect, always remains the myeloma. So that's why our efforts have always been that in a safe and tolerable way, we need to keep an eye on the biggest enemy, and that's the myeloma itself, not the transplant, not the side effects from the medications.
Very good point. Thank you, doctor. Another point that people talk about is quality of life. You've mentioned something about that, and that there's a significant difference of quality of life with transplant versus normal chemotherapy. Can you comment on that as well?
Yes, that's another very, very common statement we get, and I appreciate the question. You know, I think we've all heard, and not in myeloma, but in all cancers, patients come and with their families and their loved ones, and they might say, you know, for me, quality of life is very important, and we all recognize that. And certainly there is an increased awareness of the importance of quality of life in this survivor aspect of dealing with one of those disorders. The good news is that in myeloma, quality of life usually, not always, but usually goes hand in hand with quantity of life. And what I mean by that, effective treatments that can keep the disease under control and in consequence can prevent bone lesions or pain associated with bone lesions or can prevent problems in the kidneys or could fix, even if partially, could fix anemia, all of those things result in improved quality of life. Now, sometimes, and I use the analogy again of like paying your house with cash, right? In transplant, you do concentrate a lot of the toxicities on a short period of time. So there is no question that while you're going through the transplant and during the early phase of the recovery, there will be a decrease in the quality of life. I mean, just being in the hospital alone and just being bedridden and not being able to eat your usual foods. And then even after leaving the hospital for a few weeks, there's a period where someone, you know, has to reincorporate slowly into their normal life, their normal activities. But you do so knowing that for many patients who complete this, they can go back to a quite decent level of quality of life. In fact, when I'm talking about transplant to my patients, I'll say, you know, I bet you there's several people out there in the waiting area that you saw and are looking quite healthy who already went through their transplant. And, you know, I like to give them a little bit of what to expect. So I mentioned that Spanish study, right, the very durable responses. But there is a possibility, and still for a lot of patients, myeloma will remain a threat and we'll come back later. But with transplant and now with the advent of maintenance approaches, which we do for the majority of our patients, if you take 100 patients, you can tell them that somewhere between 4 and 5 years after the transplant, there won't be a need to intensify treatment, meaning there won't be a need to think about changing treatments or including new, you know, injections or anything else, because their disease will be well controlled without maintenance. And we can talk more about that. And even though there can be some side effects, a lot of people who have recovered from the transplant, particularly somewhere between the 3 to 6 month period after transplant, can go back to, a quite reasonable level of quality of life, going back to work, traveling, enjoying your leisure activities, sports, etc. So we do think it's a good thing in the long term for the quality of life of patients.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think from my perspective, I had 2 stem cell transplants, but more recently, I had part of my kidney removed from because I had a malignancy on it. And I got to tell you, give me a transplant any day.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Myself not gone through either. But, I sometimes say it's like recovering from a surgery. And, you know, it's going to take some time. And,
in you with the transplant. And they tend to put a bunch of holes in you, even if you use the... a robotic surgery. And if they don't, then you've got a huge incision, which takes a long time and a lot of pain medication to get through.
Sure. Well, you know, speaking of that, we are trying, and I think most centers are trying to do things that would improve the quality of life both before and then after the transplant. So let me just use a few simple examples, things that are not necessarily that innovative, but that can greatly enhance the quality of life of patients. So even you know, during the transplant, we tend to use far less of the more invasive catheters. We tend to use the larger catheter used for the stem cell collection, but then we would use a thinner catheter, which is called a PICC line, and many of you, I presume, are familiar with that, which goes into the arm. So we don't have to be poking the person for blood draws every morning. We can give the medications through that. We've done quite routinely the use of the ice chips to prevent the mouth ulcers and the irritation and inflammation that could happen in the throat in our patients. So that helps tremendously in preventing that from happening. We actually use some prophylactic medications to prevent infection. We work very closely with patients with providing them some dietary advice when they're going through the transplant. Even simple things like saying, you know what, if you don't have an appetite or if you're nauseous, let's focus on a few things. Let's use smaller meals. Let's try to concentrate, for instance, in foods that won't emit an odor or a smell. So maybe colder foods are a little bit easier. Let's break, the amount of food you eat into smaller portions. So all of those things make a big difference in how we work towards enhancing the quality of life of patients and then providing them with the support once they leave the hospital for their continued recovery.
I understand now you can also not lose your air by using cold flow through a head apparatus.
Yeah, there's some efforts in that regard as well too, and I think all of those things are very, very important. Even for sometimes we tend to think and half joke, people will say, well, but you're quote unquote a guy or a man, and it turns out we all care. That's our appearance, and it's a very public display of having to be dealing with a disease. So all of those things are very, very important.
If some doctors believe that MRD, minimal residual disease testing, will be the new endpoint for treatment. So if MRD negative, patients can discontinue their treatment. Are we there yet, or how long before we get to that point, your opinion?
If I could explain for the audience too as well. So MRD stands for minimal residual disease. And then we say MRD negative or positive, meaning we can detect or not very, very small amounts of remaining cells in the person's body. There are two methods, one of which uses something called flow cytometry that can be done by standard clinical laboratories. And there's one that it's called next generation sequencing. And that is actually something that we send out. This one, the last one, has a sensitivity of detecting one abnormal cell out of a million cells. The flow cytometry is thought to be somewhere around 1 in 100,000 cells. So what it really tells you is that it goes much deeper than what we can currently do with standard laboratory testing. This laboratory testing that we do, would really take you maybe to 1 to the -3, rarely 1 to the -4, I would say. So that when in the old days we used to tell someone you have a complete response, what you're really saying is up to my level of detection, I don't see any residual myeloma cells. But now with the MRD testing, we're taking that to a much deeper level. So it's a very, very deep way of testing for residual myeloma. Now, it's still in evolution. It's available. In fact, in our center, we do it as a matter of routine. We are hearing that the FDA is in the process of hearing and considering this perhaps as an endpoint for clinical trials, and there's some technicalities and nuances of how that may apply or not. But we don't have a full set of clinical trials or information that could guide us precisely about the specific question of discontinuing the disease. But let me give you a couple of examples. So if you go through a transplant, most of the times we would have patients come back 3 months out for the transplant, what is commonly referred to as a day 100 visit. And then we repeat a bone marrow, and now we're doing MRD. And the information there is used to say, well, if it's your MRD negative, it's important prognostic information to share with the patient and their family, because achieving that is of very high prognostic significance, a greater likelihood that one would not require additional therapy or be many years out from the transplant. It's not an absolute warranty, but it can help in that regard. The second situation is we're using this and trying to understand, for instance, in patients who are on chronic therapy. I have patients, and my colleagues may have some patients that, for instance, have been on let's say, Revlimid, that have been on that for 8 years. And then we sometimes will go through the discussion, would you like to know your MRD status now that we have it? We don't have strong clinical information, but If a person told me, you know what, I am having some side effects, I'm having more fatigue, I would like to consider discontinuing the medication, I think that would be a reasonable thing to do and to consider, because likewise, there's no data to suggest that you can be on Revlimid for that long. A lot of this is largely empirical. We do find sometimes that some patients will say, you know what, I know what you're telling me, but I'm not so sure I would like to stop my medicine no matter what the results are. So there's a human aspect of that question too as well. But the good news is that we're even having the conversation. We're having a conversation of having to develop better tools to go deeper to understand if there's any residual myeloma, and that's only because we have better treatments.
So net is we've got a bunch of clinical trials yet to be developed to answer that question.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jack, are you on the line?
I'm on the line.
All
nice
right.
Talk, Fonseca.
Hi.
I want to clarify for the audience, up to now and after my talk and my questions, the definition of transplants for myeloma patients means using your own stem cells. So I want to, for many, many years, I've heard the following statements pertaining to allogeneic transplants, or specifically using donor stem cells. One statement I've heard since I was diagnosed 23 years ago is that an allo transplant can result in a cure. And the other statement I've heard is that if you have an allo transplant, or if you're considering doing an allo transplant, it should be done within a clinical trial. So I have three questions. The first of which is, are there actually allo transplant trials available for newly diagnosed myeloma patients?
Okay. Do you want me to ask one at a time? Answer?
Well, yeah, sure. I'll ask all three. So maybe you want to just combine the answer.
Sure.
So are there allo transplant trials for newly diagnosed patients? The second one is one type of a newer type of allo transplant is referred to as reduced intensity conditioning transplants. And I'm wondering why haven't they been more successful if they ultimately replace the patient's immune system with a donor's immune system. And then I'm kind of wondering, do you ever prescribe an allo transplant to newly diagnosed patients, or is it only for patients who have run out of options?
Okay, well, thank you. No, thank you for the question. Let me start by the first statement you made regarding the plateau and the cure. That has been always the argument for allo transplant, and the idea that you incur very high risks initially because of higher toxicity associated with the transplant and the possibility of the development of this condition of graft versus host disease. But the exchange or the trade-off is that you are hoping when you embark in a treatment like this that one might end up in that curve of patients who ultimately are considered cured from their myeloma because of the allo transplant. Now, a couple of comments there. One is it's true that there's a fraction of patients that remain in that plateau. However, we know now, and including the study I previously mentioned, that's also possible with autologous stem cell transplants, so the one when you use your own cells. So I think that argument does not carry as much weight as it could have done in the past, because there is a possibility that myeloma patients who achieve great response and receive optimal induction could be potentially cured with the disease with non-allogeneic approaches. So that's the argument. And I think for allotransplants, the data has shown that this study show benefit when they're done very early, and they are not as useful when they're done for a rescue. And there's some data from the European groups, particularly Dr. Garten in Sweden, that is not very promising. And so when we're going to compare now an allotransplant, again, in cells from someone else, versus the very best of our lineup that we have for initial therapy, including, an induction with VRD, stem cell transplant, and maintenance and standard maintenance, I think it's a hard proposition for us to think of that as a potentially superior management strategy for patients. So for that reason alone, I myself have not recommended allotransplant in greater than 15 years on any patient. Now, that is not to say that one holds the truth, of course, and I know very, very seasoned and wise clinicians and clinical investigators who would do that and who have offered that to their patients and people that I respect their opinion, but I just haven't really found a good rationale to make this part of our standard a recommendation for our patients. And again, I could mention, you know, very, very smart and wise people like maybe Dr. Giralt or Dr. Maloney or Dr. Benzinger who would consider this as a potential option for their patients. I do remain unconvinced, and that's why I work like that in my practice. However, in 2017, I am a firm believer in autologous transplant itself. I always have joke when I give my talks that I'm not a transplanter, so I do participate in the transplant team, but I don't attend the transplant meetings, what they call the tandem meetings, and I promise not to shed a tear if it disappears. In fact, I probably will be rejoiced if it disappears. But I do believe it adds to the care of patients with the possibility of keeping the disease under control for longer. So we that's what we have for now. Now, the mortality is much higher with a allotransplant because of the risk of more serious complications. And even if it doesn't happen right away, one of the most difficult things we see in hematology is this graft versus host disease. Now, there's better treatments, there's ways to reduce that, but all of us who were in training in hematology don't really like to see that. That's really a dreaded complication from one of these procedures. That actually doesn't go away with a mini allo, which was your second question, because the risk is not how much chemo you give. The risk is just the other cells not recognizing now the patient's body itself and mounting this very aggressive autoimmune-type response. And there are trials. I think I can recall if there's one open in the States. There's several that have been looked for in Europe. And I'll just finish with a humorous note, which is that the last time an allotransplant clinical trial was reported in the journal Blood, which was the BMT-CTN-0102 clinical trial, my good friend and colleague Keith Stewart said that pursuing allogeneic stem cell transplants in myeloma was like second marriages. He says it's the triumph of hope over experience. And that's just summarized a lot of what we're thinking about this.
I appreciate that. I think you're right, and I'm at all not recommending allos, but in fact, I guess what I'm taking away from your comments, other than you mentioned a couple of doctors who might recommend allos, that it's kind of heading either towards not doing allos at all anymore, or again, is it considered? I mean, some doctors might consider it as for patients who have run out of other treatment options.
Now some doctors would consider it, and they will do it even outside of a clinical trial. And again, I think there's it's a defendable clinical stance, and you know, in medicine, not everything is black and white sometimes as we would want it to be, so it's a defendable stance. Now, one of the things I meant to say, and I forgot, I'm sure the audience knows about the CAR T cells. Well, the CAR T cells are a smart allotransplant in many ways, except that you're using your own cells, but now they have that drive to go back and kill the myeloma cells without having the risk of cells recognizing your body itself because they're your own cells. In fact, you can take that one step further. People are thinking, and this is almost like science fiction, but it's just absolutely incredible. People are thinking of strategies that are called allogeneic CAR T cells. So could you take T cells from other patients? You could genetically engineer them so that they would not recognize the recipient as something foreign. So you could eliminate altogether the risk of graft versus host disease, and still prime them to go and kill myeloma cells. So you would have them ready on a shelf, so to speak, so that if someone needed CAR T cells, they could be used for that. So I do think CAR T cells will at some point over the next several years totally displace the idea of allogeneic transplant for myeloma.
Thank you. That's really informative. That's it for me, Gary.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jack. I appreciate it. Yalik, your questions?
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for taking the time from your always busy schedule, Dr. Fonseca, to help educate patients. But I think most importantly, for the work you do tirelessly advocating on behalf of myeloma patients. So thanks for that.
Oh, my pleasure.
So the three of us on this call have different experiences with transplant. One has tandem transplant, one has allo transplant, and the third has not yet had a transplant. All of us have thankfully lived over a decade, and a couple of us for 2 decades. So the question I think most patients struggle with is, would I be the one who benefits the most out of a transplant, or would I be the one who will relapse months after having gone through one? How do you answer or address this question?
That's a very good question, and it's a very hard one to answer in a precise way to the patient that's sitting right in front of us in the office, in the clinical scenario. We like to think that as one embarks on treatment, you start getting a flavor as you go through the various treatment stages of what kind of disease you're dealing with. And pretty early on, you start getting some readings that would be indicative of a more favorable or perhaps a more challenging situation. I would say, given that we don't have absolute predictors of how outcomes will be after transplant, for the suitable candidate for the auto transplant today in 2017, I try to steer most of my patients to consider it seriously. I should say, I don't think transplant is a must-have, because it's just one of many other treatments. I will say that there's no one that can look at the patient and say this is something you must have, at least in my opinion. But I am of the idea that it adds significantly to the time that the disease can be controlled. So I like to put a lot of emphasis on the transplant with the caveats, again, we'll be happy if it goes away. In fact, I already said that I do believe, and I think this is quite likely, that the CAR T cells will displace allo. It is possible that the CAR T cells will also displace auto. And if you can just start thinking of a future where instead of having someone having to spend 2.5 weeks in the hospital and have then a recovery period afterwards, that as we're getting better and we have better understanding of how to manage the CAR T cells, maybe the CAR T cells will be applicable to not only younger individuals, but patients of any age and patients with other comorbid conditions that normally would preclude them from going through the stem cell transplant. So it's a very long-winded way of answering your question, because you're asking me, how do I know I am the one? And we don't really have the ability, and I don't foresee, at least in the near future, that we'll have that ability to predict individually. But if you were presented with a similar set of contacts, say in an investment scenario, I think any wise person would say, I have to consider that if this was an investment, given the overall probabilities. I don't know individually what my outcome will be. Now, there's another important layer that one must consider, and myself and others think it's critically important, and that is that as we plan for transplant, we really need to try to get as much information about the biology of the disease of the individual patient, because that is coming to be a very important marker of what to do after transplant. Very specifically, and I know many of the audience are familiar with this, we talk about the risk stratification. And this can be done in multiple ways. You can do the FISH analysis. You can do the gene expression, which is commercially available, as you know. But it's important to do that, because what you do after transplant appears to matter, and matters a lot. For patients who have high-risk disease markers, it seems that standard maintenance is just not enough. We need to give them a bit more. Now, we recognize a lot of our patients have been already through a lot and have been driving back and forth to a treatment center and getting infusions and getting injections. But we've been able to get away with the idea of using not only the combination of lenalidomide, the Revlimid, which is the standard maintenance for most patients, But we actually have combined this with ixazomib, and the commercial name for this is then Nilaropil, if you're familiar with this in the audience. And we've done this for high-risk patients. And I can tell you the experience is still pretty short. We've done this for a couple of years, but patients with high-risk markers, including I have three that I can think of in my practice who had deletions of chromosome 17 who are 2, 3, and, you know, 3-plus years out from their transplant, doing very well because of a strategy that includes these types of combinations. The reason we're doing that is because a number of clinical trials have shown that using these types of drugs, you know, globally we call them, which is a mouthful, but is a proteasome inhibitors, and that includes the Velcade, the carfilzomib, the Kyprolis, and now this one, the nilarixazomib, appears to be of importance for the high-risk genetic markers. So, again, second time I'm going to say it's a long-winded way of answering. We don't know, but we try to adjust for the individual patient.
That's absolutely fair. So you mentioned maintenance. Increasingly, trials are being developed or doctors are advising patients on study or off study to go on maintenance therapies until progression or until relapse, right? If you opted not to do a transplant from the get-go, or you are the ones that have to do a second transplant for whatever reason, are some of the drugs more prone to suppressing stem cell collection than others? Like you mentioned, like IMiDs or molecular antibodies or proteasome inhibitors?
Sure. That's a very, very important question. So I think the first point is just to affirm what you were saying, that patients who are not going to proceed to transplant after an induction, they really should be on some form of chronic therapy. Again, this may change in the future, but in 2017, I do believe that chronicity of therapy, so that is long-term use of medications, still seems to be important. And part of this has to do with the fact that the myeloma cells are not as fast dividing, so the opportunity for us to expose them to these drugs is a little bit diminished because of that. So our patients, you know, most of them we put them on some form of maintenance. And if you put that context, then the question comes, okay, how does that relate to the ability to collect stem cells? Because maybe there's a life situation that would maybe just preclude me from having a transplant now, but I don't know if in a year from now I could do it or in the summertime. And one has to consider two things. First of all, if someone has completed induction therapy, that's an ideal time to collect stem cells. So if someone could, I would recommend that they collect stem cells before they embark on maintenance treatment. Now, if that's not possible, or if the patient has to proceed to maintenance, we do have the possibility that some of the drugs could interfere with stem cell collection. We've learned a lot about that too as well, I have to say, because, you know, we were more concerned in the past, obviously, with the Revlimid. We have learned since that most patients can collect for at least one transplant. And with the advent of these new drugs that helps move the stem cells into the circulation, the plerixafor, we are able to actually do that in the majority of patients. Now, this plerixafor drug is actually quite interesting, if I may for a second, that, you know, the stem cells, it's funny because they like to live inside the bones, and you know, the space inside the bones is almost one and the same with the one in our circulation, in our blood. So you would ask the question, you know, how do they stay there? How come they don't come out? How come we have to give medication so they come out? Well, it turns out they have certain markers on their surface that make them attach to receptors that are inside the bones. So I describe this to my patients as if they have matched Velcro straps. So they have matching Velcro straps that make them stay there. And this plerixafor is like comes in between the Velcro, and that's what makes them come into circulation. And that's why we can collect it in most patients. So I would say most patients can. The other class of drugs are what we call alkylators, and that includes the Cytoxan or cyclophosphamide or the Melphalan. We don't use as much Melphalan anymore, but in the olden days, that was a big concern with regards to stem cell collection. But I would tell most patients can actually successfully complete. Now, if I may, let me give you some example. I have patients who, for unrelated reasons to their disease, you know, I have a patient I can think of, you know, a person who's a high-level professional who just told me, I just simply cannot get out of my professional life right now. I'm in one of the best moments in my career. I understand what you're telling me about transplant. Can I transition to maintenance post induction? And the patient now has been about 7 years on Revlimid and doing very well.
Okay, so my last question related to that, Dr. Fonseca, is how long can you store a stem cell? Mine, for example, is stored for almost a little over 20 years. Is it time to collect? And how long is a viable time span for storage of a stem cell?
Okay, great question. For those of the audience who don't know, the cells, when they're collected, they're frozen immediately. And the way in which they're frozen is the cells are put in a medium that contains a substance called DMSO. And the purpose for this DMSO is that it actually prevents ice crystals from forming. If you can imagine, if you freeze cells and you don't put DMSO, the ice crystals form and the cells will die. They would all burst out. But by putting these DMSO, the cells freeze, but they retain their structure. And when they're thawed, they're viable. And that's what gives that smell that comes out, you know, sometimes described as cornmeal when people get their stem cells back during transplant. Now, most centers would tell patients or think about 7 years that the cells are going to be stored. But this is more of an administrative comment. I believe, given what we know about cryopreservation and freezing, that it's quite likely that cells that have been collected and stored for 20 years will still be actually good. Now, on top of this, we always have a human factor, right? If someone is doing really well and it's been 20 years, every doctor that I know would ask the question, well, yeah, but they've been around for 20 years. What if we try to get, quote-unquote, fresh cells? So a lot of the patients will have cells recollected, which you can do always after treatment. But the very specific answer, I think 20-year-old cells probably will be good if one could not recollect cells again.
Perfect. That's all the question I had, Gary. Thank you for the time.
All right. Well, thank you. But just think how much more energy you would have with those young cells back in you. Priya, some questions from the people who are listening.
Yes, Gary, we have some questions, Dr. Fonseca, been coming in from our website. I'll just go through them with you. The first
Please.
One is, today is the 8th anniversary of going in for my stem cell transplant. That, along with maintenance dosages, kept me almost cancer-free for 6-plus years. If transplant was so successful, should I consider another one if needed? He turned 62 in 1 month. Yeah.
Sure. My short answer would be yes. If someone had a transplant and they had, you know, 6, 8, 10 years of duration of disease control, I would strongly suggest that that's considered again. When we would face a situation like this, we usually will do some treatment again, some reinduction, if you may, to be followed by a repeat stem cell transplant. If one is to do that, it's hard to give precise estimates for the person as far as how long the treatment will be effective. In general, in oncology and in cancer, you think that, as you go along through treatments, historically we have perhaps not gotten as much benefit from a repeat treatment than when we did the first time. But if someone comes with a disease that comes out several years later, I think all bets are off, and it could be that one could control the disease. You know, maybe a person like that could have been receiving VAD treatment and then a simple transplant, and now they're going to get VRD or KRD or DARRD, a transplant, and maybe some rev maintenance, and the outcomes could be as good or if not better than they were the first time around. And I cannot say they will be, but I would go with some hope and enthusiasm for that second transplant.
Thank you, Doctor. Now we have another question. Is it best to be at a point where you are in some form of remission before transplanting? I have also seen where many centers look for to be at least a 90% decrease in your M spike number. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, we like to see our patients be on their good state of control before they go to transplant. And this varies by center. We don't really have a strict cutoff of 90%, but given what we know about the current treatments that can be used for induction, we like patients at least to have 75%. Sorry for that. 75% reduction in their protein before doing the transplant. So oftentimes, you know, if we treated a patient and say, you know, we would see a patient and get regimen one and they only have 50% reduction, we sometimes will switch to another regimen. We don't require or actually do a bone marrow biopsy and aspirate before the transplant because as long as we have the protein markers, we like to proceed. Now, part of the reason for doing this is the following. Transplant is just one treatment. It's one dose of melphalan. In fact, the credit should all go to the melphalan. You know, everyone brings their cameras to take pictures of the stem cells and all of the stem cells, but the credit really is for the melphalan. That's what could, you know, takes care of the myeloma. The stem cells are the rescue. But there's significant periods of time when a person is going to be without treatment before the transplant and then after the transplant as one recovers. So if you don't start with the right foot, meaning you don't have a very good level of response, and let's say the transplant for that person didn't work as well, then you have a significant exposure there for still having a large amount of myeloma cells be residual, and that's why we like to see better responses.
Our next question is, I live in an area where one hospital does transplant as inpatient and the other hospital does it as outpatient. Is there a reason to prefer one over the other?
Okay, I'm glad they didn't give me the names of the hospital, but I would tell you what I would do. Usually, if a transplant center can do it as an outpatient, in general, it implies a certain level of comfort with the transplant procedure because most centers start with inpatient and they move to the outpatient. I personally have always thought that if I was to do it, I probably would do it as an outpatient. I just like better being in my bed than being asked my birthday at 4 in the morning before they throw my blood. So I probably would do it as an outpatient. You have to do your research about the center and the specifics, but most centers who offer it as an outpatient will have quite a bit of experience with the procedure. And then you don't have to be dealing again with the things that we normally have to do in the hospitals and be in a hospital bed and be exposed to the, you know, bacteria that are in the hospital and all those things. That's why I would be inclined to do that. But the reality is mostly a preference, and that's how I sell it to my patients when they're thinking about transplant. I say, well, you can do it as an inpatient and you can do it as an outpatient. Some people would be much more comfortable knowing that they're in the hospital. They're just a few steps away from a nursing station, and that may be very important for them. Some people might say, you know, I'd rather be at my home and just drive to the center. So the key factor is convenience because the safety for centers that have established both, the safety seems to be quite similar.
Thank you, doctor. Another one. Next question is, how is the decision to do a donor transplant made? Why are donor transplants more risky for myeloma patients than other cancers? And are strides being made to achieve better survival statistics?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that things have improved substantially with the allo transplant, which I presume that's what's referred to here by the donor transplant. And the outcomes are better for patients. You do still have the risk of, I mean, the major risk is, as I mentioned, not actually the drugs, but the concept of graft versus host disease. What allotransplanters like to do is that they give the cells, and they know the cells, there's going to be innocent bystanders, that's the graft versus host disease, but they hope the cells also will attack the tumor cells, and that's the graft versus myeloma effect. This graft versus myeloma effect is not as strong as it is for some forms of leukemia. So, you know, the allotransplant is pretty standard treatment for many leukemia forms. And also myeloma patients come into this treatment sometimes with not as good kidney function or, you know, inability to move because of the pain. So that also heightened the risk for complications. And therefore, there's been that great focus on autotransplant.
Okay, thank you, doctor. I know we touched upon maintenance, but we have another question on this. After transplant maintenance or not?
After transplant maintenance or not? You know, I would tell you that I think we're at the point now not even the most conservative of my colleagues now accepts that maintenance is an essential component of treatment after stem cell transplant. If you had your transplant in the past, and I have many patients like this who may be many years out who are not on maintenance, I don't start maintenance. But if I don't know any different, if I take 100 patients today and I were to put them on maintenance, the data is showing us as follows. The data is showing us that in general, maintenance will keep the disease away for about 2 years longer than if you don't take maintenance. And there's some early data. This still needs to be validated by larger studies, but there's early data that by as much time, there might be a difference in total survival time. So the answer to that is very simple. I would say yes. Now, again, there are situations where an individual patient on a condition may preclude this, but if possible, we put all patients on maintenance.
Thank you, doctor. We have a caller online who wants to ask a question. Person calling in from 605-1816. Please ask your question.
Yes, my name is Janet, and my question has to do, and I apologize, I came into this call late, so if you've already covered this, just let me know. But it has to do with the mechanism of action of the melphalan that's used prior to the transplant. My understanding is that it relies on a functioning P53 to signal cell death. What about those with 17p deletion that are missing at least one P53 off of one allele? Does that make the transplant maybe potentially less effective, or as long as you have one functioning allele with P53, you're good?
Great question. That's a fantastic question. You're absolutely right. It not only applies to melphalan, but almost all drugs, you know, even the Velcade and the Revlimid, they all produce certain things to the cells that make them be in an uncomfortable or toxic state, if you may. But ultimately, the cell dies if that level of the stress reaches a point that the cell goes through a signaling process that leads to cell death or apoptosis. And a lot of that is mediated through things, as you mentioned, like P53, and there's a number of other genes that are involved in this. So the whole thought process is that for patients who have some of these abnormalities, you can create as much stress on the cells, but they will have a weaker signal to go ahead and die. And that has been the biggest challenge. I think we see that with transplant, but we see that with most other treatments because, you know, again, the other drugs I mentioned, they do depend on that signaling. Now, one of the things, there's a couple of things that we're excited about. One is that there's groups that are trying to work towards being able to overcome some of these blocks by the lack of P53. This is very early. This is not quite ready for clinical trials, but it's been looked at quite carefully. But the other one is immune approaches. So one of the hope is that through immune approaches, you can attack the cells independent of what they're going to do inside the cells and what signaling may occur. So let's take that to an extreme. One example would be the CAR T cells. You know, if I encourage anyone who has the time, go to the web and look for a video of T cells attacking tumor cells. They are vicious cells. They go after the cells and they inject their poisons and they kill the cells, and they won't depend on that P53. So the answer is we're hoping that immune therapies will overcome some of this for P53 situations, but P53 can be improved, as I mentioned, with proteasome inhibitors. And I should have mentioned earlier, I'm sorry I didn't do it, for those still on the line, a few months back, I actually recorded a video, which is available on YouTube, that is was made for my patients. I call stem cell transplant for patients. So it actually explains the logistics and what to expect through transplant. It's about a 20-minute video, but I have all my patients see that before they come for their final appointment, before they go into the hospital, as I try to put it as best as I understand it, without myself being through a stem cell transplant, what a transplant is like.
Excellent. So would you still would recommend a transplant for someone that had 17p deletion?
Yes, and followed by some induction with a combination of Revlimid, usually plus Ixazomib, and you know, we've had some good outcomes with that. Emory University has a good series on that as well, too.
Okay. Thank you very much, doctor, for answering my question.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you, Janet. We are almost to the end of our time here. Dr. Fonseca, thank you so very much for sharing so much information and being so patient with the questions and all the information that you share with us. Gary, Jack, and Alex, thank you so much for your participation. Today's talk will be made available on CureTalks website. Please visit curetalks.com for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Doctor. Excellent.
Thank you.